Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
It's all been you know, the end of the shuttle program had a silver lining to it that we didn't even see it in 2011. So it's all been exciting, and I think the prospects for the future, in not only in human spaceflight, but also in planetary and exploration too, can only get better from here.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson. Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Gene McCulker is the producer and presenter on Talking Space, the leading podcast on space exploration topics. Gene's been our go-to expert for space updates, having appeared 5 times on Extended over the past 10 years. But his last appearance was exactly 100 episodes ago on episode 46. So we got a lot to catch up on. Gene, welcome back to Extended.
I am so honored to be here, Peter. Thank you for the invite. I was quite happy with your email and your invite going forward. So I'm kind of excited to be back with your audience.
Well, there's a lot of news about at the moment, Gene. Some of it's a bit off topic, some of it's a bit misleading. So we thought the best thing to do would be to cut to the chase and ask you to give us some of your insight to what's going on. And I suppose the first topic to pick up is the ISS and the current dilemma between the West and Russia over what's going on in Ukraine. There's been a lot of water under the bridge in the last few weeks, but how is it manifesting itself now? How are relationships between the parties?
Well, we got a little bit of a hint of that. If folks were following the coverage of the docking of the Boeing Starliner these past couple of days, we got a little bit of a hint of that through NASA television. One of the Russian cosmonauts was actually in Starliner helping both Bob Hines and Chell Lindgren to work on documenting the interior condition of Starliner. If you talk to anybody within NASA, or at least from the press standpoint, everyone along the line, from Joel Montalbano on down, for those of you who don't know who that is, Joel is currently the program director for the International Space Station on the NASA side. He has indicated that there has been nothing but a professional, cordial relationship between the Korolev Mission Control Center and the ISS Mission Control Center in Houston. That cordial relationship has pretty much stayed that way throughout this entire crisis. There has not really been any alteration in that. And I think the reason why is, number one, nobody's received anything from on high telling anybody the contrary, that, you know, this is, you know, relationships have been broken or anything like that. But also, I think, too, both the folks in Korolev and both the folks in Houston understand that they've got to monitor the lives, basically, of 7 people up there. They are the responsibility of the folks on the ground. So, you know, that's their bread and butter, and they're not going to go ahead and allow the geopolitical nonsense that's going on right now to interfere in keeping the station alive and keeping the crew, you know, alive and happy and making sure things on board are getting done and things are as easy for the crew as they can possibly be when they're going through their daily routine. So the relationship has never stopped. You know, it missed a beat. I mean, I know there's been a lot of bombacity in one area, and I'm not going to explore that right now unless you want to go into it. On one side of the house, there's been a lot of
bombacity. Are we talking about the head of Roscosmos here?
That's exactly
right. And his interest in social media comments.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And,
you know, he's been kind of rather, you know, Mr. Rogozin has been rather, well, bombastic in his, in his rhetoric on social media, specifically on Twitter. But, and if you compare that to what Bill Nelson has been like, Bill Nelson, the current administrator of NASA, or even, Josef Aschenbacher, the director general of ESA. Each one of them have those two in particular have had some, you know, really good professional relationships, some good professional personas out there. They haven't really dived into, you know, the rhetoric that Dmitry Rogozin has decided to embark on.
But given the debate that of where we're at now, and everyone will continue to do the right thing, I'm sure. But what's the prognosis for the ISS going forwards? Because before this all kicked off, there was talk of it being sold. There was talk of the Russians pulling out and potentially going with the Chinese. Where's all that going at the moment?
Well, as far as the International Space Station being sold, that's not going to happen. Either way, that was really never in the cards. You'd have to go through so much in order to do that, because you have not only the U.S., you know, the Destiny module and the U.S. side, but you also have the Columbus module that ESA owns, and the Kibo module that's the property of JAXA. So as far as selling it from a that was never going to happen. But as far as the future of the International Space Station, as on paper at least, it looks like we're bound for 2030. Probably a demise somewhere within the Indian Ocean, probably in the 2031 timeframe. That's where, you know, NASA wants to go ahead and basically shut everything down and put the ISS at what they're calling Point Nemo. I forget what the coordinates are in the Indian Ocean, but that's where its final resting place will be. And it's essentially a graveyard where a lot of ships have gone down in the past. So that's the game plan right now going forward. Whether or not Russia will continue to participate, I know they made some, you know, rattlings about it 10 years ago, about the lack of participation, where they were just going to go ahead and take their ball and go home. Apologize, there's a truck passing by.
No worries.
But that's, you know, one part of it. I know they've been making ruminations here about also pulling out. The trouble is this: they can't. It's really they've got nowhere else to go.
Wouldn't the Chinese entertain a potential partnership, or are the Chinese now too far ahead on their own independent trajectory, excuse the pun, to do that on their own? They don't really need the Russians, do they?
I don't think China needs anyone. at this juncture. They probably would like to have partnerships here and there, but I don't think China really needs the Russians in the way the Russians would like to have the Chinese on board with them. I think China's quite happy doing their own thing. Do I understand if, you know, the problem, getting back to the ISS, but the fundamental problem is this. You have the, you know, the attitude control and the propulsion indeed controlled from the Russian side.
Yeah.
Okay. The United States side, on the other hand, has all the power, meaning the electrical systems and so on. That and each side is dependent on the other. That's just the way this critter has been designed. So neither side can really function without the other.
Right. But on the side of projecting power into it, I mean, the systems have been designed and they're integral. There's no way around that. But certainly maneuvering the station could be done by another model of spacecraft, couldn't it? And we know in true fashion, Elon Musk has said the Dragon or a modified Dragon can do that. But the Americans have other capability as well, don't they?
Yeah, Cygnus is right now. The Cygnus spacecraft, NG-17, is set to do a, if it hasn't done it already, a reboost of the station. The difference is, though, that the attitude control of the facility during that boost phase, okay, is controlled on the Russian side.
Right.
They have control of the thrusters and so on. Yes, we could actually reboost, but, you know, to control the attitude of the spacecraft or the stability of the whole complex during that reboost phase, that is controlled from the Russian side.
Right. Didn't
so
know that.
So you still need the Russian side to go ahead and provide that attitude control.
Wow, didn't know that. Okay, well, we started off mentioning Starliner there, so let's just talk a little bit about that recent flight. Of course, it's now on the station and open. I'm trying to work out in my head, Gene, what the right question is, but let me say it as it's in my head. Was it a success?
So far, so good. So far Starliner has had a very, very, it had a little bit of an eventful docking, but that was really not due to anything the spacecraft was doing. It was more due to the, how they were going to be docking. I believe too that the reason why there was a rather long delay in the docking procedure was the fact that we wanted to get the perfect the folks on the ground wanted to get the perfect lighting for the docking so that both Chell Lingren and Bob Hines, who were monitoring the Boeing Starliner as it came in, could get the proper lighting and so on so they could really get a good look at the spacecraft as it was coming in for docking. So there was a little bit of a holdup there. But all in all, so far, the mission has been a pretty good success. I mean, we did have the loss of two of the OMAC thrusters, the orbital maneuvering and altitude, or OMAC, from one side of there, but they still have one thruster left on that particular side. So, and I believe too that the RCS or the reaction control system could provide redundancy if all three of those go out. And I believe too there was a loss of two of the reaction control thrusters on the spacecraft. They want to get all of the data that they can from the service module, because that part of the vehicle is, folks who are kind of been following this, is not going to return home. It's very similar to the service module on Apollo or the trunk on Crew Dragon. That does not return with the spacecraft that burns up and then gets detached and then burns up in the atmosphere. So they want to get all So they want to get all the data that they can from the Starliner service module, and part of the testing on board the ISS was to make sure the service module could contact the ISS, or could, you know, the comm lines between the two spacecraft were good. So they're in a process now of downloading every shred of data they can from the service module in an attempt to ascertain what happened with those that set of thrusters. But so far, I mean, you've had a good successful docking. The LIDAR system on Starliner has proven itself, as you did have the successful rendezvous and dock. It is now connected to the International Space Station, and the big cheer in the house will be on May 25th when it finally arrives back home for a landing at White Sands Space Harbor in New Mexico.
Right. Well, at time of recording, we're recording on the 23rd, so we hope that when this goes out, that will have been a successful landing. And Gene, then let's assume that she will return safely. When potentially can we see astronauts on Starliner? Because the whole mix then becomes a new ball game. You know, SpaceX Crew Dragon is not the only then option. Things get mixed up a bit. When can we start to see astronauts fly it?
Well, they're going to go ahead, take a look at all of the data from the OFT-2 mission. Want to make sure that, you know, all the I's dotted and T's are crossed. They're going to take a look at anything that may seem like a discrepancy. And once that all of that entire data package is squared away, you know, God willing, and the creek don't rise, we are looking for that crewed test flight, or CFT is what they call it, the crewed flight test, by year's end. So we're looking at fourth quarter.
Great. Well, let's go on to talk about SpaceX. Always something to talk about with SpaceX. Just one thing that really struck me. I mentioned it's been a little while since we last talked. Mm-hmm. Since then, Crew Dragon, the Falcon 9 have been routinely, and I think that's the only way I can describe it, going up and down to the space station. We've seen a Falcon Heavy launch, and now we see Starship on the move as well after its early development flight a year ago. SpaceX has set the standard, really, hasn't it? It's so ordinary now to see those boosters coming back to land on their own, but I still can't not watch it and be fascinated by it.
Yeah, I will say that the one thing that I found a little troubling, though, was the recent announcement from SpaceX that they were not going to create any more crew dragons.
Yeah.
The four that you have is what you got, and they are good for about 10 flights, I understand. So SpaceX can only fly to the International Space Station, you know, whatever times, plus they want to do other things. I know they've got some private astronaut flights going on. Jared Isaacman's got his little project going, and I guess Jared Isaacman is kind of paying for the ride, but he's also paying for the right to test a lot of what SpaceX wants to do, including, I believe, in the upcoming mission. I think there's an EVA planned. That'll be the first one from Crew Dragon.
And Gene, sorry to interrupt you there, but those four Crew Dragons. Mm-hmm. Are they the same craft that are being used for the private launches as well that we're seeing at the moment?
Right, exactly. And thereby hangs the tail. So you've really got only about 40 launches between all four of those things. And I believe you've flown a couple of them a few times already.
Yeah. So
the clock's ticking and there won't be any replacements. And I'm kind of wondering what the reaction is within NASA, because I know they want to go ahead and at least fly one crew segment a year for the ISS, and then give the other one to Boeing once they've got their act together. And Boeing hasn't really said anything. They're going to keep churning out the Starliner capsules until, you know, they really don't need them. They need to put a moratorium on them, one or the other. Because I think, too, what they want to do is they want to position themselves to become the provider for these commercial space stations that are being planned post-ISS. And the way I'm looking at things, SpaceX may not be part of that picture, because you want to go ahead and have a tended vehicle. You want to have that lifeboat capacity there too. And I just can't picture Starship being a lifeboat at one of these commercial stations.
And is that because of the size of Starship?
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't want to, I mean, something that large, you don't want to tie it up for that long.
Yeah.
So I just don't. Supposedly the craft is that Elon Musk has envisioned can hold 150 people. So you don't really want to go ahead and tie that thing up for that long.
Hmm. And Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy aside, what's the prognosis on Starship? We saw that short flight about a year ago. Are we planning to see anything else? It seems to have gone a bit quiet.
Gosh, I hope so, because Starship and the human landing system that NASA has for the Artemis program are kind of interlinked. The Starship itself, at least the crewed part of it, there's a lander that will be based on that SpaceX supposedly is working on. NASA has started training on some of the material for that spacecraft, but it's really been kind of hush hush. And I thought there was a huge announcement a few months back where Elon Musk had that lovely show that was put on out on at the Boca Chica complex, and there was a lot of glitz and glamour, but not a lot of news. And I was a little disappointed by that. I thought for sure we would get some insight into where the folks were on the SpaceX side on the human landing system, because I'm, as a U.S. taxpayer paying for that, I'm kind of interested.
Yeah. Where is the whole Artemis program then? Are we in that sort of pre-development design sort of stage? Again, that seems to have gone a little quiet.
Well, it's not going to stay quiet for very long. It'll have a very, very loud bang, I hope, with a successful liftoff of the Space Launch System in the not-too-distant future.
Well, what's happened to SLS, Gene? What actually happened? It got rolled out. I mean, I've got to say, it looks great. I don't know whether it's my 60s, 70s, looks like a Saturn V head on or what, but it looks great. But it's gone back. They were going to do some tests. They seem to have failed. What's going on?
Well, with every – I'm going to put this in context to a dress rehearsal for theater. If any of your audience has done theater – I was trying to play with an idea on how to kind of put this in the context of something that somebody would really, really understand. And if anybody, anyone of your audience has done community theater like I have, there's a week ahead of the schedule, a scheduled opening that we've nicknamed Hell Week. And in that, it's a full up technical rehearsal. Okay. Up until that point, you haven't rehearsed lights, you haven't rehearsed sound, you haven't gotten your actors have not gotten used to any of the sound effects, any of the musical cues, any of the lighting changes, and so on and so forth. So this is where the two worlds, after they've kind of orchestrated everything, kind of meet finally for the first time, meet together. And that's for that first rollout, as you were mentioning, Peter, that's what the wet dress rehearsal was really, really all about. You wanted to go ahead and start the fueling process for the very first time, making sure that, you know, everybody was on script, everything worked the way it was supposed to. There were no bugs to swat and so on down the line. And lo and behold, if as you know, anybody that's been in theater knows, the bugs are found in that process. And that's kind of what's happened that's what's kind of happened with SLS. They're in the process now of swatting the real-time bugs in there. The first problem they had was with the that was a lightning storm at KSC, and they wanted to make sure that, you know, and the complex did get hit, and it took a lightning hit that was kind of outside experience. So they wanted to make sure that everything was good, everything was held up after that lightning storm. It passed with flying colors. In fact, the lightning repellent systems on Launch Complex 39B went wonderfully. So that's one big festival cap. The other two problems they ran into, one had to do with the ICPS, the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, which has its heritage, I believe, with the Delta IV Heavy that's built by United Launch Alliance. There was a small check valve in there, and the check valve is so tiny that literally you could fit it in your pocket. And that check valve, unfortunately, got a little bulky and did not go ahead and permit the cryogenic filling of that particular stage during the wet dress rehearsal. So it's like, okay, we got to punt. We got to figure out what we want to do. Do we want to just go with dealing with the problem now and pulling the vehicle back? Or do we just go ahead, go on heritage data from the Delta IV Heavy and proceed on further? They decided to go ahead, go on heritage data from the Delta IV Heavy, right, and then wait till they get the vehicle into the VAB to go ahead and deal with the valve. So they pressed onward the following day. And lo and behold, there was another problem they ran into with the primary connector on the fueling near the core stage. So it's like, okay, let's see what we want to do, because you don't want to mess with fuel that's going into this thing. The vapors in and of itself are bad. So you want to make sure that the fuel flow is good, tight, and solid between the launch vehicle and the ground support equipment. From what I understand, it wasn't on the vehicle side, it was on the ground support equipment side. So it was time, okay, what do we do now? Do we want to go ahead and bring this thing back, or do we want to fix it in place, or what do we want to do here? It was also an opportunity to go ahead and deal with, I believe, the nitrogen line that services the vehicle as well, where we could possibly get more, you know, a little bit more response time out of that. So it's like, okay, we've got all of these things kind of sitting there all at once. Why don't we just go ahead, clear the table, bring the vehicle back? We could pull out that valve on the ICPS stage and replace the valve in there, figure out why it failed, and also address the ground support issues that are plaguing us, and also take a look and see what the environment has been doing to this vehicle as well. So they decided to bring the whole thing back.
Did you know that the first G suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
The rocket is stacked and ready to load. Is there not a set time by which sitting there stacked, the pressures then start to build up and we run the risk of potential failures? Is there a time frame when over which the rocket can't stay stacked, I think is what I'm trying to say?
Okay. There were some questions about the solid fuel, about the five segments of the side SRBs or solid rocket motors that are alongside the SLS. And from what I understand, there really isn't a shelf life on there. I mean, some people have been saying that it's a couple of months. Some people saying it's this, that, or the other thing. From what I understand, there really isn't a set shelf life to to the fuel inside the solid rocket motors. And that's been kind of thrown around in the press too. But I think they've got ample time before they really have any concerns with that. And I think that's probably year's end, from what I gathered in the press conference, in various press conferences I've been sitting in. That's probably, you know, we're not going to get to that point until year's end. I mean, a case in point, if any of your audience is into model rocketry, and by that I'm not talking about the huge, you know, multi-powered things. I'm talking about the little rockets made out of balsa wood and cardboard and things like that. And you launch off using, I don't know if the company Estes is big over in the UK, but they're kind of
it's a familiar name.
Yeah, they're the 800-pound gorilla here in model rocketry. And I've been in the field now since I was really a small kid in 1975, and I have launched old engines that I still have from that era in some of my rockets, and they've worked.
Right, okay, so I go some way to possibly answering that then. So the $64,000 question is, when are we likely to maybe see SLS fly?
Okay, that really all depends on how the wet dress rehearsal goes again. And they'll probably go ahead, go through all the data and so on. I think they're still possibly looking at an August timeframe for SLS. But again, I'm going out on a limb there and saying that because we have not gotten through wet dress. Yeah. And we have not gotten through, you know, a lot of the other things that we need to test. For some historical perspective here, Apollo also went through its growing pains as well through this. The same with shuttle. So we're still in family. This is not, you know, this is saying the whole thing's a lemon and all this. This is one of the things I keep hearing about is, you know, there are a lot of detractors there on this whole project. And we're nowhere near any of what the detractors have been yelling and screaming about.
Okay, and then one final question on the SLS, and again, it's quite a simple one actually, Gene. Is we're looking at SLS one, we're looking at the prototype, and that's ready to go. How many more SLS rockets will there be following this one?
Oh boy.
And are they being built?
Oh well, yeah. I mean the one for Artemis 2 is under construction. The one for Artemis 3 is also slowly being fabricated. The neat part about it is that with each iteration, with each launch vehicle, the team's learning. And the team's learning how to put this thing together. They're learning about their own techniques and so on. And I think as you go ahead and you learn to do, you know, these things a lot better and a lot quicker and a lot faster and with higher quality, you're probably going to see a cost reduction come down as well. So there's projections out to you know for another few years yet. In fact, I believe there are contracts signed with Aerojet Rocketdyne to continue to provide the RS-25 engine, which some of your audience may recall is essentially the Space Shuttle main engine, or SSME. But it will be modified for this new purpose. There's a new version of SLS waiting in the wings, the Block 2, which is going to be much more powerful than the Block 1. So there will be opportunities to fly. In fact, what a lot of people are kind of envisioning SLS to be is what they initially thought Saturn V was going to be, that it was going to essentially be the workhorse for the United States for some time to come. Unfortunately, the production line was canceled, but had we not done that, I believe we'd probably be launching a lot of these deep space missions on Saturn V, you know, specifically to these flagship missions. And I'm wondering too, as we go on, because I know the planetary decadal was just released not too long ago, and one of the recommendations on that that the National Academies made was that we get a flagship mission, flagship meaning, you know, something the class of a Cassini flight out to Uranus, and to here's the deal: to do it as soon as humanly possible. They want to go ahead and make sure that, you know, that the way that the National Academies has recommended that mission proceed is the fact that you've got all the technology right now you need for that. There is not, you don't have to develop anything new for this mission. All you need is the money and the go for it. And, and figure out what booster you want to fly on this thing.
Well, I was going to say, Gene, isn't that one of the biggest questions that needs to be asked? Because the satellite technology is there. You're absolutely right. You know, some of the stuff going on at the moment is nothing short of spectacular. Even when you look at things like James Webb, designed, over a decade ago?
Yeah.
So we know that we can future-proof the satellites. Isn't the bigger issue with the propulsion system and how we get it out, I mean, out of our atmosphere, you know, would that be SLS? Would that be Starship or Falcon Heavy or something like that? What would be the thinking behind the propulsion?
Right now, you'd have to see what would be available at that period of time and where you are with your own development of the spacecraft and what have you. I asked this question. I had Sawyer ask this question a while back ago to somebody with NASA Launch Services, and I asked them to give me a short, you know, sort of meatball look at, you know, what are the questions you have to ask to get your payload into orbit or to get your payload off to where you need to be. There's sort of a science behind it, and really it you have to look at mission requirements and how quickly do you want the payload out there. There are gives and takes with each option. One is, if you're going to go ahead and fly low cost, great, you're going to do a lot of gravity assists and all of that, using the planets basically as a slingshot, if you will, on your way out to wherever your final destination is. The trouble is, with that kind of architecture, it costs you a lot of time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It takes a long time, and we're talking about missions of almost a decade, aren't we? Getting to Uranus and places like that,
right? And the idea, the interesting thing that Starship offers you, or not, the Space Launch System offers you, excuse me, is that SLS could probably get you there in 3 years. Like, for instance, if you were going to do an orbital mission out to the out into deep space, out to the outer solar system, Uranus, Neptune, even if you were going to do an orbital mission around Pluto and do like a Cassini-like mission there, you could probably do it in 3 or 4 years transit time, as opposed to either, you know, Delta IV Heavy or Falcon Heavy or one of those, where you would need to do gravity assists and so on and so forth, and your exposure time to space is a lot longer. It could be anywhere between, you know, 7 to 10 years before you get to your destination. So there are trade-offs. So the idea is, what do you want to do? How much money do you have? Number one, and number two is, how quickly do you want to get there? And those are the big trade-offs right now. As far as Starship participating in it, Starship has possibilities. But to be honest with you, everybody's saying, yeah, look at it fly and so on and so forth. Well, have we broken the atmosphere yet? No, we haven't. Has it, you know, really, really fulfilled the promise that it really is trying to set out to achieve? No, not yet. One can say the same of SLS, but SLS is sitting there waiting on the runway, as opposed which is still in development.
Yeah, okay. So Gene, just coming away from maybe NEO, and we've talked there about further afield and longer unmanned missions. What else is going on at the moment? Obviously, we've seen the cancellation of things like ExoMars, so that's not going to happen, or unlikely in its current format. What else is going on in the unmanned sector at the moment?
Oh, ExoMars broke my heart, to be honest, when that happened. But I understood the reasoning for it. ExoMars has had, unfortunately, a long history. It first started out, I believe, and I'm trying to remember the exact date, but I remember when the decision got handed down from NASA to ESA about initially not participating in providing launch services. I believe that was somewhere around the 2012 timeframe, where the mission was still kind of in the formulation stage, if you will, for the Rosalind Franklin rover. That mission, we were supposed to provide, or at least NASA was supposed to provide, a booster, which kind of looked like it was going to be Atlas V at the time. And it was also to provide the transportation down to the Martian surface. I did not know at the time what that modality was going to be. But unfortunately, due to budget cuts by the U.S. Congress, we had to forego the launch services part of that. And that's basically what brought Russia in on ExoMars to begin with. The Russians were very cordial in helping ESA out with the Rosalind Franklin rover, so much so they have a platform for it. Then there was the problem with the parachutes, if you recall. And there was some issue with the geometry that ESA was having and so on. They didn't feel comfortable launching in that configuration. So they said, you know, because everybody remembered Beagle 2 and what happened with that, and they didn't want to have a repeat of that.
Yeah.
So they were like, okay, do we go ahead and miss this window and do some further testing, or do we throw caution to the wind and fly and, you know, keep our fingers crossed that everything works? They decided to be smart about it, I think, and do some further parachute testing for this. So they called in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They were happy to help with some of the data that they had with studying the Perseverance model that they were going to eventually use for the Perseverance rover on Mars. And so they squared away those problems, and we were ready again to launch once the window opened up again. And that launch window opens up every 2 years. It would have opened up right now during the summer, and ESA would have flown ExoMars on a Russian booster. Unfortunately, geopolitics happened, and the Russian aggression into Ukraine happened, and ESA felt uncomfortable working with the Russians given that environment. And unfortunately, they decided to pull the plug on ExoMars. NASA has indicated that they are looking into possibilities onto how to help get that flight going again, how to get that mission off to a start again. So we're kind of in a holding pattern right now. We don't know. The bottom line is with ExoMars, it's not going to fly this year. Hopefully, knock on wood, we'll get things squared away, things straightened out, and we'll get a launch provider together and be able to launch ExoMars somehow, either from Kourou or from the Kennedy Space Center. So I know ESA is looking into, they're first looking at any domestic launch capability. So my bet is they're probably looking at Vega. They're probably looking at Ariane 6, but they're also looking at Falcon 9. They're probably looking at Falcon Heavy. For all I know, they're looking at Vulcan, which is the United Launch Alliance launch vehicle as well. So there are options there. Which one of those are going to get the nod and eventually take the Rosalind Franklin rover to Mars is another question.
And where does that then leave sample returns?
Sample return will not be impacted by that at all. The neat part about that is the collaboration between NASA, ESA, and the rest of the partnership is extraordinarily strong in that respect. I do know that they just changed up that mission. Initially, it was only going to be one launch vehicle and one effort. A review board took a look at that and said, well, maybe you want to go with some redundancy here, just in case one of the missions don't make it or it crashes or something like that on the Martian surface. Maybe you want to go with another sample return rover / lander that could pick up the slack in the event that the other one fails somehow going out to Mars, or somehow fails during the entry and descent and landing phase. And everybody said, postponing this thing back a couple years might be smart, and that might be the way to go to do this. So that's what they decided to do. They decided to have two launch vehicles rather than just one, and two, rover lander thing, capabilities. And indeed, I believe there is going to be two launch vehicles from the Martian surface. That's kind of exciting, too, because there has never been a launch from another planet, ever. So this will be the first time we're doing this. There's a lot of firsts.
And isn't it just so exciting at the moment what's going on in the space sector? I mean, when the shuttle went, we all thought, gosh, what are we going to look forward to now? But there's so much going on.
Oh, wow, Peter. I'll tell you, I remember at STS-135, I was out at the launch pad with my colleague Sawyer Rosenstein, and we, by virtue of Sawyer, we kind of had some time out at the launch pad before the rest of the press got there. So it was just me, Sawyer, and I believe there was a BBC camera crew with us as well. And they went off, they did their thing, and we went, in the opposite direction and started to do ours. And we looked at Atlantis sitting just, it was so close. We wanted to run out there and touch it. This was just after a lot of clouds had been in the area. We just had a rainstorm in the area, and this was for the final retraction of the RSS, or the I forget what the acronym meant, but my apologies, my mind just ran and took a hit. But this was essentially the cover that remained on the vehicle to protect it from the elements before they decided to fuel it. And tradition had it that the remote service structure. Tradition had it that the press would go ahead and go out there and take pictures and so on as this cover is pulled away. Well, when Sawyer and I got there, the cover was still there. I mean, the cover was off. The vehicle was standing proud and strong, but against a very, very cloudy, stormy sky. And I thought, wow, it was such a sort of an allegory, if you will, for the conditions that were going on at that time. Really uncertain, you know, stormy. We had no idea where the program was going. We had no idea what was going on. Oh, I should have turned that off. Let me take again get to this again. I'm sorry, Peter.
Okay, no worries, no worries. Okay.
3, 2, 1. We had no idea what was going to happen. We had no idea what was going on with NASA or what the future was going to bring. It was very, very uncertain. And everybody was asking us, well, gee, now that shuttle's over, what are you going to talk about? There's no shortage of stories to tell now. The Kennedy Space Center has been turned into a multi-user spaceport. There's a launch facility no more than 5 hours away from where I live here in northwestern New Jersey out of Wallops Island, where we launch the Antares launch vehicle that delivers the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. Rocket Lab, the New Zealand company, actually it's a U.S. company, I believe it's registered here in the U.S., but their primary launch site is in New Zealand. They now will also be launching from Wallops. There's no shortage of stories to tell. There seems to be a resurgence of what's on the spaceflight realm. A tip of the hat to SpaceX. They have brought launch services back to the United States as a commercial venture. There is no shortage of stories. There's no shortage of angles you could talk about with spaceflight anymore, not just from the government side and what the government is also doing to try to foster more commercial investment in space. You know, with the commercial space station program that they want to put in place before we lose the International Space Station, so that a presence in low Earth orbit, your humans' presence in low Earth orbit, does not, you know, go away, or even NASA's presence in low Earth orbit does not go away while it's trying to do the heavy lifting of exploration. NASA still wants a foothold in low Earth orbit, and will be a tenant, if you will, of one of these commercial stations that NASA wants to kind of encourage businesses to establish, and so on. And there are three companies that NASA is working with to go ahead and establish these new outposts to sort of replace the International Space Station. And they are also working hand in hand with ESA to try to figure out how that transition is going to take place. The same with JAXA as well. They're trying to go ahead and work out how that transition is going to take place. But they're trying to dot all the I's and cross all the T's again before the International Space Station goes into the drink, because they don't want to have a gap in low Earth orbit capability. Because it's been awfully critical to NASA, not only from a testing standpoint for the Artemis program, because a lot of the gear that's being tested for Artemis has been tested on the International Space Station, but also just for private investment. There's a lot of private experimentation going on ISS, and they want to keep that door open. So there's that as well. There's just so much going on in the program now that we didn't even envision back in 2011 when Atlantis sat on pad 39A, and we all wondered, gosh, where do we go from here? And pink slips were being handed out just as Atlantis had cleared the tower that day. So a lot has happened, and a lot has transformed, and it's all been for the good. Admittedly, there was a lot of job loss locally in the Florida area as a result of the shuttle program's demise, but all of that has come back and then some. SpaceX has built facilities at in and around the launch center at Cape Kennedy, or should I say at the Kennedy Space Center. Same with Blue Origin. They have facilities in and around the Kennedy Space Center. Boeing has taken over two of the three old shuttle hangars, if you will, the OPF, the orbiter processing facilities. There's just so much to report back on, and it's all been pretty wild ride if you look at it, but it's all been a great story.
It's all been, you know, the
end of the shuttle program had a silver lining to it that we didn't even see it in 2011. So it's all been exciting. And I think the prospects for the future, in not only in human spaceflight, but also in planetary and exploration too, can only get better from here.
Wow. Well, on that note, Gene, thank you so much for putting us straight on a number of those stories. Where can we find you and Talking Space online?
We can be found at www.talkingspaceonline.com. We can be downloaded pretty much wherever you can download a podcast. We're trying to get into some other providers, but we're on Google, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on iHeart. We're on a lot of the other podcast providers currently. Even our host Podbean, if you're listening to them through their app, please by all means. Our Twitter account is at Talking Space. Mine is at GeneJM29. So if you want to stop by, say hi, or poke a stick in my cage and say something on the show, by all means, please, as long as you're nice about it, I'll respond. And if you're not, well, you know, you'll get what for. But but again, Peter, I've loved our time here. I've loved being always, I love the invite.
No, it's great to have you, Gene. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, your audience is like a kindred spirit. I grew up around airplanes too. I mean, shoot, you know, I was a little kid watching them fly out of Newark Airport over in Jersey City. So
yeah,
I and Teterboro. So
you're an Av geek at heart as well as a space geek.
Oh yeah.
Well, Gene, thank you so much for joining us. And that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including the Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. That's it. It's goodbye from Gene.
Take care, everybody. It was always an honor talking to your audience, Peter.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.